We come on to the second in the five aspects of Dhamma life, according to Bhante. And of course, while I'm talking about each of these, I'm hoping that you're reflecting on yourself, and I hope that in your groups you're talking about how you put these into effect in the midst of your life. That's the whole point of it, that you're looking at everything that you do to see how you are working on this particular aspect. So yesterday we talked about integration. How is integration represented in your life, in all the major areas of your life? Today we're talking about what Bhante calls positive emotion. So how is that represented in your life? How is the effort to develop positive emotion represented in your life? Where are the areas of difficulty? Those are the interesting ones. Where are the areas where you forget to develop positive emotion? How do you deal with that? This is the whole point. So what Bhante calls positive emotion, that category, as it were, of the kind of efforts that we make, the kind of practice that we engage in, is a further stage in working with karma. We saw that integration is taking full possession of your moral agency, so that you experience yourself fully as responsible for your actions, as an agent. But we need to go a bit further than that. It's not enough to feel that you are responsible. You've got to do something about how you act. So first of all, this skillful karma is really what positive emotion means. And to use the term positive emotion in the talk on the system of meditation, I think because he was starting by arranging the various practices in a sort of hierarchy. So he was trying to show where Maitri Bhavana, Metta Bhavana, fits into the schema. So naturally from that he spoke about positive emotion. But actually, when you start to look a bit more closely and start to generalize these elements of the system into aspects, even into stages, positive emotion is far too fuzzy. Positive is a distinctly fuzzy term. Quite a lot of positive I feel quite negative about. And emotion is, in English, a very, very fuzzy word indeed. It covers mere feeling as well as motivation, if you see what I mean. But in Buddhism, this is used much more precisely. We're much more precise about the volitional side of things and the affective side of things and the felt side of things, if you see what I mean. I'll come on to this a little bit more in a while. But when we speak of positive emotion, that's the term that Bhante's given us, we need to be quite clear that what we're talking about in saying positive is skillful, kushala, kaushalya, in that traditional Buddhist terminology. And what we're talking about when we speak of emotion is really more motivation or volitional activity of body, speech and mind. In other words, karma. So really this stage is the stage of the development of positive karma. The previous stage, the previous aspect, integration, is really, really fully grasping the fact that you are a moral agent. Letting that come fully into your awareness. Realizing fully what that means. But now you need to start to work in the moral field. You need to work to develop skillful karma. This first of all implies dharma vichaya, the discrimination of mental events. You remember the Bodhiyangas? It starts with sati, the first stage, then dhamma vichaya. So here, developing skillful karma, first of all, requires you to be able to tell the skillful from the unskillful, to be able to know what volitions, what emotions, what actions are skillful and what are unskillful. We've of course got, first of all, to understand in rational terms. We need to be able to recognise what we mean by skillful, what we mean by unskillful. Of course, skillful and unskillful can be spoken of in terms of their effects, and they can be spoken of in terms of their qualities. So the skillful has a beneficial effect in the world, has a beneficial effect on you, modifies you, especially in the direction of greater openness, greater awareness, greater happiness, fulfillment, and so on. It's characterized especially by feelings of love, of friendliness, of well-wishing, maitri, by a mood of generosity, of openness, not holding yourself back, not closing yourself in, but opening yourself up, not gathering things to you, but giving them over. And it's characterized by mental clarity, by the recognition of what really is to a greater or lesser extent. That's the characteristics of skillful. Unskillful, of course, is the opposite. So, yes, we need to train ourselves to recognize the skillful and the unskillful. We need to be quite clear what they mean, and we need to train ourselves to recognize them in our own experience. We've got the guide of the precepts to help us, and the precepts are very, very important in developing skillful action, skillful karma. They tell us, in general, the kind of behavior you could expect from someone who is entirely skillful. Somebody who's entirely skillful naturally, because they don't have the seeds of the unskillful in them. They tell you how the Arahat behaves, how the Buddha behaves, how the Bodhisattva behaves. One who has eliminated self-clinging. Such a person naturally acts skillfully, because there's none of the underlying causes of unskillfulness, which has its roots in our self-attachment, our self-obsession, you might say. So the precepts give us a broad outline, a portrait of somebody whose actions are completely skillful. So from that, or against that, we can sort of check our own actions. We can engage in the act of apatrapya, or we can activate apatrapya, our sense of moral shame in relation to those we respect, those we morally respect. Not those we fear because they will reject us, or who we want to impress because then they will employ us or give us some benefit, but the people who we morally admire. We, as it were, learn to see what is skillful and unskillful in relation to them as described by the precepts, whether the 5 or the 10, or however many you like. But it's not just a question of training in that sort of indirect sense of checking your behaviour against some external or abstract or mentally experienced, conceptualized framework. It's learning to see the skillful and unskillful through a direct moral sensitivity. This, of course, is encompassed in the term kri or hiri, which is often spoken of as moral shame, in the sense that you feel a direct sense of moral pain as a result of an impulse to act in a certain way, or even the action in that way. It's extremely important in Buddhism. Deliberate cultivation of that sense of moral sensitivity, the moral sensibility. It's in a way equivalent to, for instance, an aesthetic sense. When you look at something beautiful, when you look at, you know, beautiful spring day, when you have that good fortune, it doesn't happen very often at the moment, when you see a beautiful spring day, you don't need to sort of check, now wait a minute, what are the characteristics of a beautiful spring day? Oh, sun's out, yes, sun's out. Oh, trees are blooming, yes, etc. You know, you feel it very directly. You know, you can feel your emotions opening up, you can feel the smile come to your face, you can feel your blood warming, the energy flowing, and so on. You don't have to be told that this is a beautiful day. There are states in which you're so alienated from what's going on that you do find yourself thinking, oh, it's a beautiful day, but you can't feel it. But most characteristically, you directly experience beauty. Your aesthetic sense is natural to you. It's not conceptualized. It's a felt sense. So it's the same with the moral sense. There's an immediate moral disgust or approbation, an immediate sense of, if you see it in others, of admiration. When you see somebody do something really good, your heart goes out to them. When you feel you see something that's morally wrong, bad, unskillful, you can sense yourself withdrawing and shrinking, as it were, from it. And the same in relation to yourself. This moral sense is a key aspect of awareness. So often when we talk about Smriti or Sati, we speak of it as if it's a cold, hard searchlight, looking in a very objective, cold way at things, seeing them as they are. So that's the way we sometimes think of it. But awareness is, if you like, warm. It's sensitive. When you're truly awake, when you're truly mindful, you're also aware of the aesthetic quality, of the truth quality, of the moral quality of life around you and inside you. And it's this fundamentally that we need to be training ourselves in a direct moral sensitivity, which is natural. It's very, very significant. In Buddhism, morality is in the end natural. It's natural in the sense that karma is, as it were, built into things. It's part of the way things are. It's also natural because we have a natural responsiveness to the moral quality of things. And we're learning to sense that. So we need to be training ourselves, yes, in this moral sensibility. I should stress that this sense of the skillful and the unskillful, this responsiveness, this feeling of opening up to the skillful and shrinking from the unskillful, is quite different from a responsiveness to the nice and the nasty, if you like, a feeling of pleasure and pain, in other words, feeling of like or dislike. It's very, very significant that skillful states can be painful and unskillful states can be pleasurable. In other words, the experience of those skillful states may, in the first place, be accompanied by pain. So, for instance, when you recognize your own past unskillfulness, that is, from a Buddhist point of view, highly skillful. But you feel a painful sense of regret. I wish I hadn't done that. Often one wants to make a face like that. Ah, a sort of disgust, feeling of disgust, or wish I hadn't done that. And that's painful, in a sense. You don't feel pleased that, you know, you did that. You feel pain, you feel regret. Remorse and regret are, in Buddhism, highly skillful mental states. They can be. Hri and Apatrapya, when they're connected with unskillfulness, are positive mental states. But they're painful in character. Rather, they're skillful mental states, but they're painful in character. I think this is why positive is not a very good term, because it crosses the boundary between pleasurable and skillful, and you can get them mixed up. In Buddhism, there's a very sharp, clear distinction made between Vedana and karma, between pleasure and pain, and skillful and unskillful. So yes, skillful states can be painful, where, for instance, when you've experienced remorse or regret. There's also a sort of painful sense of loss when a skillful opportunity or creative opportunity passes from you. You may feel regret when you leave the retreat. You may feel a skillful sense of regret when you have to leave, because something that's been so constructive for you, so creative for you, is now over. So it's natural to feel, I'm sad about that, which is, in a sense, a painful experience. And I think it's actually quite important to feel that, to know that you regret. You know, that when you part from a friend, you feel it. I remember another seminar with Bhante up there in that tartan carpeted floor, uncovered by Surita's detritus, which seems to be a feature of this retreat. Bhante is talking about a song of Milarepa, the story connected with songs of Milarepa, where Milarepa is seeing Rachumpa going off to India again. And Milarepa has pleaded with Rachumpa not to go. But Milarepa knows best, and off he goes. And Milarepa sits on a rock, gazing after him for a long time. And some of his disciples come and, you know, say to him, well, what's going on? What's happening? And Milarepa says, Rachumpa, my heart son, is leaving me, and I will never see him again. He knew that he'd be dead when Rachumpa came back. And I feel sad. And Bhante sort of dwelt on this and said that, yes, we have this idea that even such an exalted being as Milarepa, who clearly had penetrated very deeply into the Dhamma, even he felt this loss. And he said, yes, when when something creative is in play, you regret its passing, you feel its passing. In a sense, he'd never be parted from Rachumpa. Milarepa was beyond that. In a way, Rachumpa was beyond that. They were always being in contact. Bhante said he was always in contact with Dada Rinpoche. He never felt his lack, that he was missing. But nonetheless, when you part, something can't happen. Something very, very creative can't happen. So, yes, where there's real friendship, real connection, real creative situation, you feel it's going. And if you don't, you can't appreciate its presence. So that, if you like, is a painful feeling, but it's a skillful feeling because it's connected with the unfolding of the Dhamma. You, of course, when you see your friends suffering, when you see anybody suffering, you'll feel it. If you're at all human, you'll feel it. You'll feel the pain of that. But that empathy, that maitri, is very, very skillful. So we mustn't mix up painful with skillful. You know, a lot of painful feeling is unskillful, or rather comes from unskillful action, rather. But the pleasure and pain in themselves are not skillful or unskillful. They're simply vedanas, vipakas. I don't have to explain that to you advanced students. And similarly, the unskillful can be very pleasant. There's, the famous English saying, revenge is sweet. When you see your enemy fall down, there's an inner sense of delight. We don't have a proper word for it in English, but the Germans, of course, do. Schadenfreude, if I've pronounced it correctly. That terrible emotion of delight in another's pain, another's suffering. A very important term. In fact, I think it's quite useful to identify it, because so often we can, sort of disguise it and hide it from ourselves. We English are very, very adept at this, disguising under a veneer of politeness our delight at others' discomfiture. the Germans are able to just say, that's what it is. Yes, well, one could go on. There's a long list of these pleasurable, unskillful things that we do. Of course, not everything that's pleasurable is unskillful. Some of it's just innocent, neither skillful nor unskillful. You know, the pleasurable taste of cooking is not in itself skillful or unskillful. The craving that goes with it, of course, is. And so on. The delights of sex in themselves are innocent. It's our craving that gets mixed up with that, and the projection and so forth that gets mixed up with it, that's the problem. So yes, we need to distinguish pleasure and pain, vedanas, vipakas, from skillful and unskillful, the moral kinds of karma, moral categories of karma. And a lot of our Dhamma Vichaya is connected with this, disentangling vipakas from karmas, seeing that this is something that, as it were, is nothing to do with me, it's to do with a me in the past, or to do with somebody else altogether. It's not your fault that you suffer from particular social circumstances. But how you respond to that, that's your karma. That's where skillful and unskillful comes into it. You know, you can't be blamed for, you know, a brick falling on your head. How you respond to that, that is up to you, if you're awake enough to do it. So, yes, the first aspect of skillful karma, this aspect of our overall training, is distinguishing the skillful and the unskillful, and especially distinguishing them from the merely pleasant or painful, the vedana quality, the vipaka quality, the vipaka aspect of our experience. I do think this is one of the most misunderstood aspects of Buddhist teaching. And if you can really clarify this, it's very important to be able to, in your own experience as it unfolds, to recognize what is simply what's happening to you because of previous or other conditioning factors, from what you're setting out now through your volitional activity. That's extremely important. And of course, to recognize that those vipakas come from a complex of different conditionings. Karma is only one of the conditionings that plays upon your vipakas. Very important in India, where caste is often associated in the Hindu mind with karma. You're born into a particular caste, it's taught, because of your previous karma. Many modern Buddhists turn that on its head and say, well, I've been born into this particular caste through my good karma, because Dr. Ambedkar came from this caste and we've converted to Buddhism. They're having fun, if you like. So you can't fall back on this sort of argument. Social categories are mind created, they're not karmically created. But very important to be clear that not everything that happens to you is the result of your previous karma. Some of it is, not always easy to see what is and what isn't, but a lot isn't. So we need to be very clear about this and to learn more and more to catch this moral flavour in our consciousness, this sensitivity, sensibility. It's very interesting. You'll often find on retreat that you become more morally sensitive. You become more morally sensitive to your own mental states and to what's going on around you. I hope you experience this. And you can often feel, as you go back into your life, a sort of blunting. I remember this very strongly from a long solitary retreat I did on a Greek island. Oh, hardships of life. It was in winter, I assure you, and it did snow. All the Greeks came out in the road and started dancing, shouting, "Vrechi, vrechi, snow!" They were just so delighted at the snow. But anyway, just to tell you how hard it was. Anyway, I remember coming back from this retreat and going into Athens, which is a pretty grim city until you get to right to the centre. And I remember my sort of moral sensibility, my aesthetic sensibility, sort of really kind of wide open and quite shocked in a way at what I was experiencing. And gradually, after a while, I'd become used to it. Didn't take that long. I'd become used not only to the ugliness of so much of the surroundings in that city, but also to the sort of coarseness of behaviour and interaction I saw around me. So we can recognise this moral sensibility opening up and then see it gradually closing down. So we need to be struggling to open up our moral sensibility. And that I will have more to say about later on, because context is very important in this connection. So then, of course, in the schema of the Bodhiyangas, Dhammavicaya becomes virya, effort in this case. And effort here means the effort to choose the skillful. The skillful doesn't naturally unfold. When you think in the schema of the four kinds of person, stream entrant, once returner, non-returner, arahat, it's not until non-returnership that you break greed and hatred. You only weaken them with once returnership. So those strong, unskillful motivations remain in you almost until you've lost your taste for the sense world. So they go very, very deep. The roots of unskillfulness are very deeply embedded in the whole structure of our psychophysical being, if you like. And it requires a lot of effort to work, to choose the skillful, and to reject the unskillful. Effort. Deliberate, conscious effort. Checking ourselves. Saying no. Choosing situations which promote the skillful. Rejecting situations that promote the unskillful. Requires a lot of effort. It doesn't happen naturally. The spontaneous in Buddhist thinking is mainly a moral dereliction. You know, we rather privilege us the spontaneous. If Mathieu will forgive me, I think we have to blame the French a lot for this, or at least Rousseau. That sort of idea of the natural man, you know, the sort of anarchist idea that if you strip away all the layers of conditioning, of education and so forth, you're left with a pure, spontaneous, natural, positive human being. It isn't like that. I'm a hippie. I was a hippie, rather. Not one anymore. I'm a Buddhist. but, you know, that's what we thought would happen. You know, if you just got rid of all the you know, straight society and all the straitjacket of things, everybody would just be naturally good. Don't you believe it? This is what India's like. And it's not like that. Hinduism is not about morality by and large. It's just about a way of bribing and corrupting. It's not a religion that therefore lends itself to morality. It requires a lot of effort, at least in its general form, I should stress. But yes, developing skillful states requires conscious effort. It requires rejecting things in yourself. It requires discriminating certain trends and tendencies in yourself. Yes, in a sensitive and sympathetic way, understanding what underlies them and so on. But in the end, saying no. It's a very important point. I think it's one we still have to struggle to make clear, even within our movement, despite poor Bhante's 50 years of teaching. We still have these ideas that, the one I keep hearing still is that there's a developmental model and a non-developmental model. There is no non-developmental model. Yes, effort has to be accompanied, as we will see tomorrow, by phases of non-effort. But there's no model, in other words, a model of spiritual life which does not consist in conscious effort, in conscious development. Realistically speaking, whatever you might say, sub specie aeternitas, if you dare to get so Latin at. If you look at things from the final point of view, yeah, of course there's no effort. Buddha doesn't have to make an effort. He's got rid of everything that you have to make an effort to get rid of. So having got rid of what you have to make an effort to get rid of, you don't have to make an effort. My logic is clear, irrefutable. But when you're not there, you have to make a lot of effort, accompanied by phases of non-effort, as we'll see. But make no bones about it. The order you're joining is one in which the training is about effort, at least in 50% of what it's about, maybe even more than 50%. Even your non-effort is a kind of development. So we need to be very clear about this. Non-developmental models are not dharmic models. You get them in some sorts of Advaita Vedanta and Krishnamurti and things like that. But in Buddhism, there's definitely a developmental model, an idea of growth. Don't take my word for it. Go and look at what the Buddha has to say. You have to grow in this Dhamma and discipline. That's what the Buddha says. That means making an effort. Samyakvyama is a key aspect of the Eightfold Path. So going for refuge means making an effort. You don't just flow on to enlightenment. If we did just flow on to enlightenment, well then everybody would be flowing on to enlightenment. And what are we spending all this money on retreats for? And why am I working for so little pay, for so little result? No. That's what you when you commit yourself, you're committing yourself to making an effort to develop skillful karma. Of course, a day will come when that effort becomes more and more natural to you, and it flows more and more from within you. But if you give up that effort prematurely, well, that way lies moral dereliction and even perhaps a sort of madness. There's a very strong cautionary tale in the Life and Liberation of Padmasambhava about a monk who misunderstands very advanced teachings which are intended for people who've entered the stream of the Dhamma, which are mainly emphasizing just relaxing and allowing things to unfold. And this monk misunderstands this, and he thinks that he should just follow his inclination. And of course, his inclination takes him into all sorts of unskillful behavior. Well, the text sets out what happens to him. And it's some pretty bad things, the worst of which is 500 lives, 500 rebirths as a toe sucker. You have been warned. I don't know, some people are a bit strange, so toe sucking might sound really very attractive, but rebirths as toe sucking, you know, the occasional toe to suck is okay, but a whole committed lifestyle of toe sucking is really not very attractive to me, but chacun a son goût. I'm getting carried away. We need to be careful about misinterpreting teachings that are intended for those who've really broken through self-clinging to a pretty decisive degree and applying them to ourselves prematurely. We will get something of this, as we'll see, tomorrow. But we need to be doing it in a context of a great deal of effort. And that effort, of course, is the four right efforts. I'm sure you all know what they are, the effort to eradicate those unskillful mental states that have already arisen, the effort to prevent the arising of unskillful mental states that haven't already arisen, the effort to keep in being, maintain skillful mental states that have arisen, and to create, to develop those unskillful mental states that haven't yet arisen. So it's this constant effort to work with your own mind and, of course, your speech and your behaviour to develop the skillful and to get rid of the unskillful. This is really fundamental to the early stages of Dhamma life, which means pretty much operatively the whole of spiritual life. It's when you get to the point where you don't have to make much effort, well, you just glide with it, and you don't mind making an effort anyway, pour encourager les autres. Of course, we do this through precepts, following the precepts, through meditation practices like mindfulness of breathing, like Maitri Bhavana, and so on, and all the other practices too. We consciously develop the skillful mental states and mental attitudes, skillful experiences. Especially we develop this through communication, through the exploration of what it means to be skillful, what it means to be unskillful, looking at deeply into the springs of our unskillfulness, trying to find in us deeper sources for skillfulness. We work really hard to uncover what's going on in our moral life, in our the psychology of our moral life, through confession. I said something about that yesterday. Deep confession, which isn't just a feeling of regret and admitting, but exploring what happened, why it happened, what the conditions in dependence upon which it arose, external conditions, internal conditions, looking at how you can put right what you did. If you don't put it right, you're likely to do it again. If you put it right, the lesson comes home much more dramatically, and you let go of that remorse. You feel the very pleasurable consequences of confession. It's amazing. Confession is one of the most enjoyable practices you can engage in. As you face up to what you've done and admit it fully and completely, you'll feel a greater and greater sense of what in Pali is called avipratisara in Sanskrit, which is the sense of the innocent sense of freedom from remorse. Freedom from remorse isn't just a sort of neutral sense, it's a sense of moral worthiness, a sense of moral pleasure. You can look at yourself in the mirror when you shave. You can think of yourself without blenching. You can think of yourself with a kind of pride, I mean a positive pride, not arrogance, but a sense of, yes, I'm doing okay. There's nothing with which I need to reproach myself. So, when you confess, you clear your conscience and you feel this experience of freedom from remorse. I remember this on this long solitary retreat I did. The first thing I began to experience was a great deal of remorse. Just sort of things coming into my mind that I'd done, some going way, way back in my life that I really wish I hadn't done. And to begin with, it was really oppressive and I felt really bad about it. But I gradually worked out how to face up to it. Even some things that seemed to come from deeper than this life, I could never pin them down. I began to get some sort of story for them, whether it's the true story or not, basically that I'd killed in previous lives. Given that I was born in 1947, it's pretty likely. And just sort of gradually facing up to them, and I noticed a sort of a surge of this very positive sense of self-regard growing. It's very difficult to put your finger on it because everything you say can sound so like a kind of arrogance. But I felt more and more at ease with myself, more and more at peace with myself. And eventually I just started looking for things to face up to because I was enjoying it so much. So yes, if we engage in that sort of enterprise, it sharpens our moral sensibility and means that we're more and more likely to choose the skillful. In the end, it's a matter of direct experience. That the Buddha says in the Kalama Sutta, doesn't he, that when you of your own experience, you might even say of in your own conscience, know these things to be blamable, because they lead to harm to self and to others, then refrain from them. So your moral life emerges from this direct sensitivity, and of course the opposite, when you know through your own conscience, through your own moral sensibility, through your own experience, that these things are praiseworthy, praised by the wise, delightful to you, because they lead to happiness and pleasure for self and other, then do them. That's what you're fundamentally trying to cultivate in yourself, your effort to develop the skillful, to work at skillful action, skillful karma, at positive emotion. This is what it's fundamentally about. Metta bhavana, of course, is one of the most important modes for developing this, but it's by no means the only one. So I want to just, having, I hope, given us a clear idea of what this aspect of spiritual practice is about, of a complete Dhamma life is about, I want to talk about two very, very important issues that I think need stressing. The first of these is the need for supportive conditions. This used to be stressed so much in the early days of the movement. I'm not so sure that it is stressed as much these days. I'm sure it is at Padmaloka. It's very difficult to surmount difficult circumstances. In the first place, the influence that's strongest upon us is other people. We are pack animals. We're descended from apes. And in India, one of our major retreat centres is in the jungle. And one of my greatest delights on retreat is studying the monkeys. Not the ones on the retreat, but the ones in the jungle. Although there's not such a great difference between them, including this one, quite astonishingly. You see all the same kinds of behaviour going on, the jockeying for power and position, and trying to get all the female apes. They really get some ugly ones. But anyway, maybe it's Shakan again, Arsongu. Getting carried away with my own rhetoric. What was I talking about? The human environment is the one that has most impact upon us, because we want to be accepted, and we've got a sort of natural fitting in mechanism. We naturally wish to conform ourselves to those around us. And it's okay. It's a perfectly ordinary natural instinct, because we need others to protect us, to support us, to give us benefit. We want their approval, we want their acceptance. Much more naked in the Indian context. Here we're much more roundabout about it, because our circumstances are so much less pressing. In India, you really need the group. You depend upon it, because, you know, it may be that people take against your group. You need the solidarity of the group, even quite immediately, physically, to protect you. If there's a riot of any kind, you need people who will come and defend you. If in working life and in social life, you need the protection of Aplilog, our people. That is, people from our caste and community. It's a natural human mechanism that's become formalised in Indian society, in the caste system. We have our own versions of it, which are much more sort of muted and indirect and so forth, but they're there. It's quite natural, and we shouldn't beat ourselves up for having that instinct. It's embedded deeply in our animal character. The upshot of that is that who you associate with has a strong influence on your development, on your capacity to develop. Until you've developed a high degree of moral sensibility, a high degree of individuality, to call it that. Individuality is nothing less than moral sensibility and moral agency. Until you develop that, you're very strongly affected by the people you connect yourself with. I don't, I'm sure, need to labour this point. It's almost intolerable to be isolated, to be alone, to be unable to relate. And you'll do almost anything in the end. A human being will do almost anything to fit in and to be accepted. I've just read that extraordinary modern Russian novel, Life and Fate, which I highly recommend. It's a brilliant work aesthetically, although it's not a pleasant work, as it were, in terms of the suffering that it portrays. But one of the most striking incidents in the novel is where one of the key protagonists of the novel, who's a Jewish scientist, who is at the cutting edge of fundamental physics, makes a fundamental breakthrough, which is not accepted because anti-Semitism is beginning to creep in. And he finds himself outcast. And at one point, he's required to make a statement about another physicist who is considered politically incorrect. And Grossman, the novelist, so accurately unpicks the human response. So you feel completely with him in his shameful betrayal of a friend and a colleague. You completely understand why he did it, even though your moral revulsion is also evoked. It's completely understandable. There's this, his whole life is in his work, and his work is being betrayed, undermined. And in the end, he betrays as somebody who's done nothing by denouncing him. Later, there's an equivalent when one morning, out of the blue, the phone rings and it's Stalin at the other end. And again, you're shown his really primitive delight at being given the approval of the big boss, even though he knows it means nothing. So I thought that Grossman's exploration of totalitarian society reveals something about the nature of what it is to be a human being and what human society is like in an unparalleled clarity. It is really one of the greatest novels I've ever read, actually, certainly of the 20th century. It's not an easy read, and it's a big one too, and it's quite complex, but the level of insight into humanity has a touch of something more than normal, as it were, something even, you might say, transcendental, where the novel meets the Dhamma, as it were. So yet, we'll do almost anything to fit in, that's my point. And you shouldn't strain yourself too much. You need to make sure you have regular recourse to people who support your efforts. I see this in India, where people are very deeply embedded in ordinary society. Our order members are deeply embedded in ordinary society. Family, work, neighbourhood. It's very, very difficult to keep your head above water, spiritually speaking, dhammically speaking. So you really need to make sure, this is the most important thing that could be said to you, you need to make sure you have readily at hand recourse to spiritual friends. Is probably the most important factor in your life. We all have an unrealistic idea about ourselves. The comfortable nature of modern Western society tells us that we are strong. And it hides from us our real human weakness and poverty. It hides from us just how frail as moral beings we really are. We in Britain, Maitreya Nagarjuna, as we're travelling around, says, you can really have a very nice, comfortable life here. I don't think he's tempted. He's made of sterner stuff than that. But yes, it's a really nice life for most of us here. There are parts which are not like that. But for most of us, it's a really nice life. And the reality of the situation can be easily disguised from us. A decent middle-class life, you know, means not very much moral compromise in the most immediate sense. We need to be careful that we don't overlook the reality of ourselves and of life in this cushioned, comfortable, cotton wool existence, which feels very hard because you have to work hard to earn these days. But morally, spiritually, it's easy for us to overlook where we're really at. Bhante said to me not so long ago, just before, in fact, he became quite ill. He said he thought that most people didn't realise how far they are from enlightenment. I think he's commenting on all the stuff around at the moment about insight and stream entry and all the rest of it. He said, most people don't realise how far they are from it. And he said he thought that actually what we needed to do was realise more how far we are from it if we really wanted to get near it. Paradoxically, you don't see the Buddha until you realise the Buddha is not there. So yes, we need to recognise the reality of our situation in a quite realistic way, dropping our arrogance with humility, recognising our deep need for spiritual friendship, and making sure that our lives are so structured that we at the very least have regular recourse to spiritual friendship. And that we live as much as we can, as much as in our power to choose, with our Dhamma friends. If we don't have that power, if we've got responsibilities that don't allow that, then we make sure we are regularly able to have that kind of recourse. And we try to make sure that even within the situations that we do, as it were, have to be in, or choose to be in, we try to make them as supportive as possible. I've spoken quite a bit about this, and I think we need to explore this much more fully insofar as these days the great majority of people are in families in one way or another and have working lives which are unconnected with the Dhamma. You need to do whatever you can, unconnected in the formal sense with the Dhamma, if you see what I mean, with the movement at the very least. You need to do whatever you can to make those lives supportive of your Dhamma effort, particularly by making sure that if you're married, that your wife does understand what you're trying to do and, if at all possible, actually supports and encourages it. She realises it's not a threat to her. In a way, it is, but in a way it isn't. I mean, it's a threat always because we're going to change. So we don't know what's going to come of that change. But, you know, you need to make it clear that, well, you're going to honour your commitments, you're going to honour your responsibilities. But within you, within that, it's extremely important to you that you you work on this moral and Dhammic dimension. And you can't be a full human being, you can't be fully happy unless that is happening. Because the stultification of your Dhammic efforts is itself dangerous. Dangerous to you, dangerous to others. Remember Bhante saying that he was concerned about totalitarian societies, communist societies, particularly at that time in the 60s and 70s, because they negated and denied that element within people. And he thought that that would mean that something went sour within the society, within the culture, which then become destructive or take destructive courses. This is the same for us. It's not a question of an option. It's something about us that has to be fulfilled. One needs to try to communicate that to the key figures in one's life. Not always easy. And one needs help and support of friends and needs to be patient and take one's time. Needs sometimes to recognise that it needs to be put in other terms for people because they come from a different framework and so on. But it needs to be possible for you to be what you are in your deepest aspiration, or at least for that not to be denied or suppressed. Very difficult. You need to make sure that the activities you engage in, that you have some choice over, the entertainment you engage with, the environment you create around you, is all supportive in the sense of being, enlivening, refining, and so on. There's so much more that could be said about that. There's a whole field that needs to be gone into. Above all, make sure you get on retreat as often as you can. One of the great disappointments often of ordaining people is that they've been coming on retreat faithfully for 4 or 5 years, you know, 2 or 3 times a year. They're ordained, and they think, arrived, don't need to bother anymore. Please don't do that. Because what happens then is you lose touch with something. Something that's very difficult to keep alive in the midst of a busy, engaging life. And you subtly begin to compromise. That's the greatest danger in the West, is a sort of compromise with a good, liberal, middle-class life. Where Bhante says the good is the enemy of the best. So you let something in you go to sleep, and you just compromise, and you're not really that different from any other, you know, good middle-class citizen. You do your job, you do your duty, you're good with your family and so forth, but there's not something extra, there's not something greater about you that you committed yourself to, that brought you to commit yourself. So yes, we need to work with our conditions so that they enable us to develop skillful mental states, so that they are both an arena for skillful action and a support for skillful action. Then I'm not going to dwell on this, although it's a large topic that demands a much bigger treatment. But if our Dharma lives are to be successful, we need quite a bit of delight in them. The Buddha said that at one point he was asked what are the most difficult things about spiritual life. And in connection with entering into the Dhamma life, he said the most difficult thing, the most important thing, is to find delight in it. Because if your Dhamma life becomes dry, you can't go on with it. You won't go on with it. Of course, there will be periods when there's no delight, I assure you. There are bound to be periods of struggle, periods where you know, you can't remember what you were doing and so forth. And it's only a sort of intellectual recollection that keeps you going. But you need to make sure you keep delight alive. What Bhante said in a very important aphorism many years ago in that front room at Padmaloka for I think it was a chairman's event: guard your sources of inspiration. So the things that give you delight, delight in the Dhamma, guard them. I'm giving you all my gold today. If you follow all this advice, you'll be a very wise man, my son. Better than me. Learn from my mistakes. Guard your sources of inspiration, your springs of inspiration. Without the spring, the crops can't grow. Without the spring that brings the water. Have you seen Jean de Florette? You remember the spring is dammed, so Gérard Depardieu dies. cut a long story short. We need those springs of inspiration, those sources of inspiration, those sources of delight. Rarely comest thou, spirit of delight. Well, we need to make sure that spirit of delight comes a bit more than rarely. Otherwise, life just becomes very dry and dead and dull, and we just end up compromised. That's what happens when you haven't got that inspiration. You become compromised. So developing skillful action, developing positive emotion, includes guarding these sources of inspiration, making sure that your Dhamma life is rich and flavoursome and moist, so that something can grow. And that means knowing, again, it means, again, integration. It means knowing where those sources of inspiration are, what you found inspires you, what has really worked, and working to keep them in your life. Unfortunately, when you become dull, the last thing you want is a source of inspiration. When you become very dull, when you turn on the telly, you don't look for, you know, the Shakespeare play that's being performed that night. You look for, well, we won't even say what you look for. I don't know. So, yes, we need to have as a very strong element in our lives, the guarding of sources of inspiration, the guarding of delight. If you have delight, if you have delight, you have zest. If you have zest, you easily make an effort. Effort comes naturally out of zest. Zest comes naturally out of delight. So I think one of the most crucial messages of Dhamma light life is making sure you keep delight in it. And that means a lot of work, a lot of exploration. And it may mean even taking rather roundabout routes at times. I don't want to excuse anybody's vagaries, but at the same time, it's not always obvious where those sources of delight lie, because they're kind of to do with, often, with imagination, to do with richer depths within oneself, with myth, as I talked of it yesterday. And finding delight isn't a sort of, tick box matter. It's a matter of experience and examination of experience, and then conscious cultivation. But of course, unfortunately, when you consciously cultivate, you can kill. So it's a delicate art. You know, it's the art that the artist has to work with. If you over-consciously create your poem, it's metrically correct, but poetically dead, and so on. So it's a question of a very deep receptivity. But that is another story. So let me just conclude by touching again on the importance of effort. That effort made in a context of clarity about what is skillful and unskillful in yourself, in a context which supports you and with a strong dimension of delight, feeding and supporting. But in the end, you've got to make that effort wherever you are, whatever your conditions. And the conditions will never be completely all right. And often, strangely, the best conditions are the worst conditions. Sometimes, for all that I've said, don't seek them out because they'll seek you, the difficult conditions. Don't worry, they're coming for you right now. Difficulties are heading your way as we speak because life is difficult. Zindagi mushkil hai. Moments of difficulty will come, and they're your major opportunity. Because in those major opportunities, you will be tested. And in that testing, you have the opportunity to come from something deeper, something bigger. And you can even, in those moments of difficulty, break through. So for all that I've spoken of the importance of a supportive context, in the end, you've got to work with what is. I remember, again, on that tartan carpet, I remember I was working as Bhante's secretary. I worked as his secretary here for 8 years. And at one point we were in the midst of one of the worst crises we've had in our order. Somebody who'd been very close to Bhante turned against him, and turned against him in a very ugly way. I mean, at one point he was stopped from coming to see Bhante with an axe in his hand. I mean, nasty. And I was working closely with Bhante on this because it had some legal implications and so on. And very unpleasant indeed. And I must say, I found it really unpleasant, nasty. I didn't like it. I didn't want to be engaged in it. And one day I talked with Bhante about it. It must have been about the worst period of it. And Bhante, you know, we parted with, I had to go and do something, phone a lawyer or whatever. And as I was leaving, Bhante must have noticed the sort of demeanour that I carried myself with, a sort of downheartedness, dragging my feet and looking, you know, dark clouds hanging over me. And he sort of stopped and he said, "No, wait. We mustn't think of this as something bad." How can you think of it as anything else but bad? He said, "You mustn't think of it as bad. You must think of it as an opportunity or as a test." He said, "This is testing our understanding of the Dhamma. It's testing our practice of the Dhamma. It's testing our emotional positivity, our skillfulness. And that is the spirit in which you must take it. So in the end, skillful karma, positive emotion, has to be exercised in life as it is. Don't go seeking the difficulty. They will come. But when they do come, don't think of them as something wrong. Then you really have to practice skillful karma.